So this is our last meeting for this session and for this year. It's also the last session in which we will be focusing specifically on the theme of time. We're now going to go on starting in January 11th, I believe it is, and spend several months working with space. And in some ways, that may be, for some of you especially, that will be a very different experience, because in the space section, we are mostly focusing on the space portion of dynamics of time and space. And those of you who've been participating in these calls for a while, we'd spent a whole, I don't know, a long time working with that section of dynamics. So it should be, this will be a chance to go back through it again. Very different from what we've been doing with time, because we've never, as a group, in all these years, worked with this particular section of knowledge of time and space. And in general, I think people tend to be less familiar with that text. But here we are. We are now very familiar with the discussion of time and knowledge of time and space. And we're going to take another look at it this morning. So, we'll start right at the beginning. The beginning of the first chapter, in on page 112, Rinpoche says, the dimension that allows temporality itself to emerge as invariability remains hidden. Let's just stop there. So, we've talked about invariability over the last several sessions, and my sense is that, you know, there's invariability, and then there's kind of
I could quote the book if I could find something, there's invariability, which we try to kind of incorporate in our usual temporal structures, but then there's a more fundamental invariability, which has a lot to do with great time. And I think that's what he's pointing to here, the dimension that allows temporality itself to emerge as invariability. So you might ask, well, what is that? What does it mean to say that temporality emerges as invariability? We don't know how to get there. That dimension is hidden. But the claim is being made. Temporality is emerges as invariability. And we want to understand more. We've been exploring that, but I want to come back and look at why we would say that. Sudhi asks the question here, is this the same dimension that we often refer to as, or that I often refer to as prior? Yes, I think it's fair to say that. Let's see, what can we say? Yeah, it depends, of course, what you mean by prior. I was actually teaching a class in a course on based on Revelations of Mind about time. And we talked about something rather similar, and actually one of the students had a nice way of framing it, I thought. So you can talk about the prior, you can also talk about before, but of course before in the ordinary sense is definitely within the temporal structure. And so we're trying to make a distinction between that before and another before, which is prior to the whole temporal order. And we started talking during the course of the class about the big before, and I kind of like that. So the big before, if we're talking about the prior, then we could say that's the big before. It's the one that allows the whole temporal order to emerge. And so it's not before in a temporal sense. It's not prior in a temporal sense.
but it's fundamental. And what's being suggested here is that it involves an invariability. So Hayward asked, is invariability an absolute? Well, of course, you know, the natural TSK answer to that is to say, no. There are no absolutes in TSK. And I think that's right. What you might say is that because this invariability is in a different dimension, as this first sentence says, it, from the point of view of the ordinary temporal structure, because it goes beyond that structure, it's in some sense absolute. But I still don't like the word. I mean, I think it just pushes us in the wrong dimension. And Sudhi comments on that, prior to appearance to become the focus. If I understand correctly, you're saying that we have the realm of what appears. We have the realm of what unfolds, what comes into being. And all of those require the usual temporal structures of past, present, and future, and cause and effect. And yes, prior means prior to all of that. And so here, and because it's prior to all of that, it's, with respect to all of that, it's invariable. It's always there. And I suppose that's why there's, you know, it makes some sense to talk about it as an absolute. There's no getting away from it. There's no, there's nothing other than. So, what I want to ask to start with is, what does that mean as a truth of our lives, you could say? And I think there's a simple answer. I don't think it's the whole answer, but it's a simple answer, and that is that in our experience, in our lives, in our world as we inhabit it, temporality is invariably available, invariably active. And so in that sense, we would like to be able to access that invariability, which is going to be different from any particular experience of time or anything that's located in time, or I think you could even say anything that goes outside of time, because when you talk about going outside of ordinary time, you're using the categories of ordinary time. So
invariably present is nice.
Invariably present? Yeah, I think that's right. Invariably present, I have here in my notes, invariably active and available. But later on in this chapter, Rinpoche will talk about presence as the place where this invariability shows up. He may not put it quite that way, but that's approximately what he says. And so there is a link to the dynamic of the present. It's not the present of past, present, future in the ordinary sense. We'll look at that, but I think people have a feel for that. So Caroline asks, well, from that perspective, nothing comes and goes? Is it true to say that from that perspective, nothing comes and nothing goes? Yes. The categories of coming and going are very much within the temporal order. The categories of cause and effect, coming to be, from and to, which are some of Rinpoche's favorite examples. He's always talking about how we're caught in the notion of from and to. So right, in this invariability, none of that applies. Nothing comes and goes. Does that mean that, we talk about a timeless realm? That's another way that Rinpoche talks about it. But does that mean that it's static and it's frozen? No, it doesn't. But it's not the kind of dynamic, the kind of aliveness is not the aliveness of coming and going, which in our ordinary understanding, that's where we look to see. You know, it's sort of like, do you want to find out if someone is dead and alive? Well, you put your, or alive, you put your lips, your ear down to their lips and see if they're breathing, right? Does the breath come in and go out, come in and go out? That's the kind of dynamic and aliveness that we understand. This is more fundamental. So that aliveness, that invariable presence, I'll go with that, it's hidden from us. It's a dimension of experience, and it's hidden from us. So, you know, sometimes, you know, we talk from time to time about how these teachings connect or don't connect to some of the things people are interested in quantum physics. And this is a good place to point out what seems to me important, which is that usually, at least, there's a fundamental difference. Because physics talks about hidden dimensions. I mean, I'm thinking now about string theory, which, you know, is a controversial theory. It's not accepted by everybody. But they usually say there are 10 or 11 dimensions. There's the three we're familiar with, or the four counting ordinary time. And then there's these other hidden dimensions. But, you know, the way that gets talked about in physics is that those are completely inaccessible to us, those other dimensions. And they're, you know, they're so incredibly small that they really have nothing to do with our presence in the world, with the way we embody in the world. Now, maybe somebody could find a way to bring that into contact with our ordinary lives. But in this case, you know, what we're talking about, when we talk about a hidden dimension, it's a dimension that we need to activate in our lives, you know, and not as some theoretical construct. And of course, that's always true in TSK, and it's a fundamental issue. And one of the reasons it's fundamental, you know, and I'm talking now about people who are, I mean, especially if you're training to teach TSK, but if you're working with it yourself or talking with others, there is a tendency to think that what's being presented here is some sort of abstract theory about the nature of time or space or knowledge, and it's not. It's about, and this is a pretty nice way of talking about it, it's about activating a vision, that's how we've generally talked about it, but activating a vision in which this hidden dimension, or so you could say, you know, learning to enter this hidden dimension would be another way of saying it. That's what's going on in our lives. So our lives are transformed. Well, a number of examples come to mind, but I think they'd maybe take us too far afield. And I think the basic point is clear. So there's a couple of things here. Sudhi says, it's from this dimension of invariable time that Longchenpa says, since everything is just an apparition, right, perfect in being what it is, etc., one may well just burst out in laughter. That's right. I mean, at least it seems to me that quote and that whole approach, that strain in Buddhist thought is very similar, or is pointing in the same direction, let's say, as what's being talked about here. Caroline says, this reminds me of the Buddha's stating that he was never born and will not die. This is, you know, that's a big topic in Buddhism too, and it's variously interpreted, so I don't think we need to go into it, but yeah, it seems to very much relate to this sense of the invariable, right? And then you quote T.S. Eliot saying that all time is eternally present. So Eliot had very interesting things to say about time. I've never studied him in any depth. I did quote, I guess, from one of his poems the other day. But, I think you will find in different thinkers some sense, it seems to me, you could almost say a response to the mystery of time. You know, we've talked about that time is mysterious. Someone sent me an article this morning, actually, talking about how maybe instead of our ordinary time, there's another time simultaneously operating that flows in the opposite direction, but it's hidden from us. We don't have access to it. So it's a whole separate universe. That's interesting, but it's theoretical, again, you know, I mean, by definition, in that particular formulation. We have no access to it. And so it seems to me the main reason why it's helpful to consider such options is just to remind ourselves that time really is mysterious. We don't understand it. Okay, we're still, we had gone halfway through the first sentence, and I want to continue. So this dimension that allows temporality itself to emerge as invariability remains hidden. Why? Because, and I guess this because structure is, you know, suggests ordinary time, but okay. Because ordinary consciousness allows for no knowledge that would know it. Now, I think I've mentioned in here that in our sessions that as we move into this third level time, we are really emphasizing more and more the relationship between time and knowledge, or you could say great time and knowledge. And here, that's suggested. We just don't have access. Ordinary consciousness does not have access, or does not allow for a knowledge that would know this hidden dimension. And that's a very general statement, but it's also a very valuable clue. If we wanted to enter this hidden dimension or activate this new vision, we need to develop a different knowledge. And so I think that the exercise that was assigned for this week is very relevant here, because it's exactly about activating a different knowledge. And I actually want to have us do the exercise in a few minutes. We'll spend a little more time setting it up. Do the exercise with this sense of allowing this dimension of in which temporality emerges as invariability. So the exercise talks about that each one of our senses, so it's focused on the senses, can actually project knowledge forward in new ways. And the exercise just asks us to start with one of the senses and invite knowledge to enter into its activity. So the reading, the sentence that we've just been looking at, says that we don't have access to the knowledge we would need. And the exercise says, well, you know, let's just take this head on and invite a different kind of knowledge. Right? And it's very interesting, it seems to me, that the reading and the exercise they use similar language. In the reading, we're moving on now to the second sentence, a landmark in our journey. It says, we could describe this non-allowing by comparing the mind to a mirror, because a mirror only presents two dimensions of the objects that are reflected in the mirror. And we have to infer the existence of the missing dimension. Now, we have the experience which allows us to make that inference. But the mirror itself is just in two dimensions, and so that's why it's used as an example here. And there's a pretty similar image in this exercise 20, which is in the first paragraph of the comment. He says, you know, don't worry too much about how to do this exercise, just do it. And then he says, if an image seems useful, imagine that the senses go off at right angles to the usual course of perception in this new dimension, each sense faculty can enact its own body of realization. So that's very much the sense of you know, it's that right angle, it's that third dimension that's missing in the mirror, and the suggestions being made here that we could go off into a new dimension in which a new knowledge becomes available. So this right angle image or mirror image is a good way to think about it. I'm not sure that we should stay quite as literal as that. I mean, that's good, it's helpful. But since, after all, we're talking here in this paragraph about a mirror, it reminded me of the TSK exercise that we've worked with in the past, which is awareness as a reflective surface. And I think, Ken, you mentioned that last week as a valuable exercise here, or maybe it was transcendence of pointings. But anyway, it's a good... Say again?
Oh, it was transcendence of pointings.
It was transcendence, okay. Well, I'm mentioning this one. Awareness as a reflective surface, which does suggest, again, the images of a mirror and the images of allowing, right? The image in that exercise is that just as a mirror allows any image, we can allow experience in a different way. And of course, that relates back to the discussion mention in this paragraph that consciousness does not allow, right? It does not allow the knowing that we would need. So there's a sense, it seems to me, in which you could say that the missing dimension, the right angle, the third dimension that's missing in the mirror is the dimension of allowing. And at that point, the analogy to the mirror breaks down. We're kind of leaving it behind. But you could say that you know, when it says here that that ordinary consciousness does not allow the knowing that would know this missing dimension of invariability, you could say actually that what ordinary consciousness doesn't allow is in fact the allowing, you know, the allowing of the mirror. The whole structure of ordinary consciousness is in some ways a structure of non-allowing. Ordinary consciousness sets up a certain understanding of what's real by not allowing anything else, you know, by narrowing down the range of what's possible. So we'd like to be able to access this hidden dimension by allowing a different knowledge. The exercise offers the opportunity of doing that. And if you look at the next paragraph, this hidden dimension is described, and describe is not the right word really, but it's pointed to. When the mind looks at the temporal play of events, so the mind here is really ordinary consciousness, right? It reflects back to observation only specific configurations of past, present, and future, not revealing the dimension of their underlying union. So it seems fair to say this dimension of the underlying union of past and present and future is the same as the dimension in the previous paragraph that we started with, the dimension that allows temporality itself to emerge as invariability. So everything is presented conventionally, and in that conventional presentation, that underlying union, which is also the invariability of time or of the temporal, that's not allowed. And we're looking for a knowledge that would allow that invariability, and we have to be able to investigate that. We have to find a way of investigating it. So at the very top of 113, the text raises the difficulty with that. There's something at the very starting the last few words of 112. There is something inherently contradictory in trying to arrive at an understanding of timeless time through initiating a temporal process of inquiry. Okay. So the inquiry itself has to be timeless, and that seems to refer us right back into allowing, right? Because allowing is just an opening. You don't go anywhere. You just allow. And so if we look at the exercise, the practice, which we will do now, it involves inviting or allowing a knowing to show up within sense experience. And although the exercise isn't specifically directed in this way, I think that we can use it in this way. That knowing that shows up within sense experience is can be the knowing also that allows this hidden temporal dimension of invariability. So let's practice now. I'm sorry if it took a while to set that up, so I hope you won't get impatient. But here we are now. We're going to practice for about 5-6 minutes. So it's exercise 20, letting the senses know in a new way, allowing that. Okay, let's practice. okay, let's come back together. So the exercise suggests that it's not, you just do it, don't worry too much about how to do it. It's not immediately evident, I think, how to do it. But I think that connecting it to time in the way that we're doing this morning is helpful. It just helps bring us closer to or gives us an avenue, a way in. So we have a comment from Hayward. It appears that knowledge knows what the senses see and hear. This takes me out of it. Well, that's, I think taking me out of it, taking the self out of it, seems really important. I was certainly noticing in doing the practice, the exercise, that what takes, I'm going to do it the other way around, you know, what takes me out of the exercise is stories, you know, is interpretations and events. And this is, I think it's very well known. You will know it well from your own experience. If we're organizing experiences in order to make sense out of it, then we really are just completely, squarely, invariably, but I don't mean that in the sense we're talking about, without possibility of exception, let's say, caught up in a temporal order and in past and present and future, and my concerns, my wishes, my needs, my regrets, my memories, all those emotional reactions, that all comes up. And so it does seem really important to take me out of it, and I think you're right, Hayward, that by letting us say, well, let the senses know, you know, so that there's kind of an intimacy between knowing and sensing, then you don't need to have an interpreter, a knower, a witness, all of that. Okay, Klaus says, pain that was hidden in the forward momentum shows up again, and the painness of the pain can be used as a gateway into invariable great time. So, some of you are aware of the discussion of pain in relation to time that Rinpoche goes into in Dynamics of Time and Space, and I think you're relying on that, Klaus. It's a very interesting. It relates to what we've been talking about because the self, when it thrusts itself into experience, is setting up a particular way of being that has a quality of pain that seems to be almost inevitable, and it's a very interesting question, you know, what's the relationship between the painness of the pain and the invariable temporality of what happens in past and present and future? That's a part of what we could ask. Okay, Ken says, the senses are usually seen as reporting within the structure of ordinary knowledge. This new way is different. Right. Absolutely. We think we know what the senses are there for. You know, we have an explanation, or you know, we have a story about that. I mean, we know what it means to see, we know what it means to hear, and so as a result, the senses themselves are not free to know because we've already assigned them their role. You know? So this new way is different, and then the question is, you know, what's the nature of that difference? I don't know if you have more to say about that, but that is what we want to be exploring. Okay, John worked with hearing, and let me just say that it seems to me that, you know, hearing, for various reasons, seems to be closer to time. It's than seeing. Seeing tends to freeze things. Okay. I chose hearing. I, too, experienced the release of the interpreter. It became knowledge to knowledge, knowledge as presenter, knowledge as audience, with a beautiful display of vibrations all around, known by hearing. Okay, well, that's a nice description. And I don't have any anything in particular to say about it. The turning away from the knower. So, you know, I refer to this phrase all the time because it seems to me so central in the TSK vision, that knowledge is not what the knower knows. And here, as you say and as Ken was saying, this is an invitation to a different kind of knowing, in which it's not the knower who's doing the knowing. We're saying, well, let the senses do the knowing. And then, if the senses do the knowing, to bring it back now to the issue of invariable time, maybe the timing that's available to ordinary consciousness and to the self as the owner of that consciousness, all that kind of drops away, or it doesn't limit us in the same way. Okay, Michael says, the still center is often not so stable in daily life, right? But as Lao Tzu makes clear, the spinning cartwheel relies on the hub at the center. A house relies on a doorway to be of any use to its occupants. Perhaps the present moment can be like that still center, allowing a quiet stability from which to view the broader span of time. But when the present moment gets caught up in the locomotion of the self's concerns bouncing along the rutted roadways of life, we lack that quiet space from which to feel the invariable and the abiding in daily life. Okay, well, that's also very nicely put. In principle, you might say it shouldn't have to make a difference, because whatever manifests in the temporal order, whether it's stillness or agitation, still has access to that invariable time, which is the big before, you know, the prior, what's underneath, which is this dimension that we don't ordinarily have access to. So, in principle, whatever shows up, you know, there's a line in a Tibetan text, I mean, in translation, that says something like, stir up some more of these manifestations, you know. It's like, fine, let them all show up. We don't care. We'll take it all. We'll take anything. We'll work with anything. That's in principle. In practice, you know, we are so easily carried away, and that carrying away quality is exactly the indicator that ordinary time is in operation, carrying us away through the stories, through the concerns, through the explanations. That's the life that we live. So that quiet space of the still present, yeah, that's very important. And maybe in a minute there's still some more comments, but maybe in a minute we'll look a little about look at what Rinpoche says about the relationship between the present and invariable time. Karen says, noticing the ordinary way, how the senses work, isn't this noticing already an act of opening? I tried to work with touching, hearing, feeling, the strong gravity of specifying. Okay, well, that's a very nice point, it seems to me. And it's one that does get made in the TSK books repeatedly, you know, that knowing or not knowing, it's not exactly what you said, but it's roughly, it's in the same area. Knowing or not knowing may already be the knowing that we need. You know, it's not as though we have to go somewhere else. It's that we need to understand. So there's a very famous line by T.S. Eliot, since we've brought him up. I don't have it memorized, but it says something like, We shall not cease from all our journeying until we arrive at the place from which we started and know it for the first time. And it's that knowing it for the first time, it's when we can arrive at our starting point and know it for what it is. You know, if we live in a world of constructs, and we could say illusion, but I don't mean that really in a negative sense, but if we live in a world that's manufactured, and we understand it to be manufactured, maybe that's the point, or at least that's a very powerful way of investigating. So, yes. And Ken, I don't think he's commenting on Karnans, because he's talking about access. I've kind of lost where the access would be. Without such access. So, Ken, maybe you have to say a little more, because I've lost the thread that you're commenting on. Without such access, would anything be? So do you mean access to invariable time? Ken, you've been replaced by pure light. That's something about your video that does that. But maybe from out of that some words can emerge. Well, I'll give you a chance to do that. Let's take a look at for a moment at because we don't have much time. Let's take a look at this place. There's some interesting things about alchemy in this chapter. If we had more time, maybe we'd talk about them, but that's okay. We won't worry about it. So on page 114, there's a discussion which is a kind of a straightforward discussion in the sense that it works, it seems to me, with first-level ways of thinking. It's talking about the linear past and the linear future. It's in the second full paragraph, and how they connect to each other. And then he moves from that back more toward the point, it seems to me, that we're really investigating. He says, the three times appear to share a common being, united by an unseen dimension. So this is that dimension again, that opens into the invariable, right? And so he says there's a, you know, there's past and present and future, but there's also an undivided dynamic, like a circle or a wheel. And maybe we could go back to the image that you used, Michael, of Lao Tzu's image of the hub of a wheel, which remains silent. You know? So there's an undivided dynamic of the circle or the wheel. And then he specifically links it to the present, and that's where I wanted to go. He says, this hidden dimension of time, which links past and future, allowing their interplay, manifests directly in the present, the ever-active agent of time. Past and future images of each other complement the active power at work in the present. They equally express the subtle rhythms and forms of becoming to which a unitary time gives rise. So here we arrive at the present, and it turns out, you could say, that this invariable time is also the present. But I think we need to be a little careful here, because it's not, the point instant present, this always moving point that separates the past and the future. But it's more like an active presenting, and one way to think about that is if you go back quite some time ago when we were looking at the way that time is explored in the middle chapters of the first TSK book, there's that series of exercises which invites us to become aware of the fact that past and present and future are always available, that in every present moment there is also the past and the future. And those exercises, I think, are really, really powerful exercises for, you know, challenging our usual, very limited sense of past and present and future as these three separate domains that somehow interact in some mysterious way. If they're all available together, and that's what those exercises suggest, then that also points us strongly in the direction of invariable time. So, what comes out of this, I mean, we're at the end of our time and we're at the end of this session and we're going to take a relatively long break now over the holidays. So I just want to summarize a little bit. What comes out of this is that there's a practice that we can be doing. You could think about this as the walkabout. But it's like it's the great walkabout because it's always available, and if we connect with it, it activates the vision, and that is that this invariable dynamic, invariable presence, Hayward pointed us towards, or active presence. This invariable dynamic is available within each moment, within each experience, and it doesn't have anything to do with the content of the experience, and it doesn't have any. It doesn't depend on identifying past or present or future. Whatever arises, there is this invariable dynamic to be experienced. And I think if we work with that over the break, that in itself will be very powerful. And it's a it comes up again at the very end of the reading, so let's turn to that and then we'll stop on 116. He says, I'll just read you the last paragraph. I think we'll just stop there. If each succeeding moment of time presents the entire realm of existence, the full distributed wealth of an infinite becoming, if we could know just one moment of time in all its fullness, what would be left unknown? Okay, we'll stop there. Enjoy the holidays. January 11th, we'll be back together. Thank you very much, everybody.